Sully's back for a choke point because three routes into and out of the Seattle area are going to be closed for construction this weekend. So it's time to start planning your trips, or at least planning to stay away. Chris is here with details.
Definitely. Yeah, check out this list of closures. I-5 southbound, the I-5 express lanes, and the Montlake Bridge are all going to be closed this weekend.
So it's going to be a really busy weekend. We're going to need people to plan ahead and be prepared for delays.
Let's start with the I-5 southbound there. The Washington Department of Transportation's Tom Pierce says all lanes will be diverted into the collector distributor just after James Street at 10 p.m. on Friday night. Workers are replacing expansion joints there, and they are also going to smooth out some of the bumps created by recent paving.
We did the new paving first because it's easier to line the expansion joint up with the new pavement than to like do the expansion joint and then go in and make the pavement match that.
I drove that stretch of I-5 on Friday morning. Those bumps are a real pain there south of downtown. So smoothing them out will make for a much better ride. But this work is going to make getting to the Sounders match very difficult and getting to T-Mobile Park for the Mariners series difficult. Highway 99 be a much better option for you getting into the stadium. That closure, by the way, on I-5 southbound lasts through Monday morning. Now, complicating matters, the I-5 express lanes are going to be closed in both directions all weekend. Pierce says workers there are replacing 26 broken concrete panels.
We're going to go in, we're going to dig out those panels, go all the way down to the dirt, make sure we've got a good base underneath it, and then we're going to pour new concrete panels.
The express lanes will close at 9 p.m. Friday night and won't reopen until Monday morning. And now to the Montlake Bridge. And I know what you're saying. Didn't they just close that thing for a whole month?
That's exactly what I just said.
Well, I could hear you thinking it. And that closure was for replacing the bridge deck, all of those 84 bridge panels now. Now they need to go inside and work on the guts.
We need several weekend closures to work on the mechanisms that help raise, lower, and lock the bridge into place.
So that's what they're going to be doing there this weekend. Going to be a couple more weekend closures of the Montlake Bridge as they continue this work on that mechanism. All of those are going to be done when the Huskies are out of town. The Montlake Bridge closure begins at 10 p.m. on Friday night. So add all of this up, and it makes for a very disruptive construction weekend through Seattle. And Pierce says the backups really depend on you. How you choose to get around will make all the difference.
If people use the alternatives, if they carpool, if they take transit, if they postpone trips that they don't really need to make, or if they use alternative routes, that's going to lessen the backups. If everybody tries to do the same thing that they always do, we're going to see really long backups.
So it's time to start making your travel plans for this weekend now, and maybe just stay away from downtown Seattle.
Do you think people actually do that? Because every weekend when we say there's problems in Seattle, there's still backups. I can sort of, you know, see it in the periphery as I take an alternate route. And I just don't know if people are changing their plans just to avoid this, right? Like, well, they put out the warning every time.
Yeah, I mean, some people do, and I mean, I guess some people forget what weekend it is, or they don't plan, or they think ahead. But, and you're right, getting into Seattle or getting into Bellevue these days, even without construction, can be incredibly difficult. And on the weekends, when there is construction, it just makes it worse. If we don't do some alternate planning for the I-5 southbound closure, because that one's a biggie, you can be backed up to 85th getting into Seattle all weekend long, which would be a giant pain. So remember, only one lane gets through that collector distributor to get back onto I-5 there out of downtown. So that's four lanes down to one. So that's going to be very, very different.
Okay. Maybe things will be different this time. Thank you, Sully. The owners of an iconic Seattle restaurant are going above and beyond to lift up fellow Black business owners. Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott has this story.
It's been more than 35 years since Lewis Rudd co-founded the first Azell's Chicken in the Central District, and he remembers just how many barriers they faced as hopeful business owners in the Black community.
When we first started out in business, the conversations that would come up around systemic racism and redlining, and it was just not a lot of awareness there to where people would listen and with the intent to understand that it was a handicap.
For example,
5 years that it took for Azell's to get financing before the restaurant was open in 1984. Then after the business is open, applying for a loan, and it's taken 6 months to get the loan. but only after a state legislator called the vice president of the bank to communicate to the branch manager to process our loan. And back then, when I would share that story, people couldn't connect the dots to the redlining, where the system was designed not to provide capital resources to homeowners and business owners in that zip code.
Rudd and his co-founders eventually managed to get the funding they needed, but it took years and along the way.
Now, after the fact that gentrification has taken place, the property values went down. Developers, whoever came in, bought up the property. Now the community has been revitalized, rebuilt. And a lot of those black business owners that were there 37 years ago when we started our business were no longer there. Couldn't afford to be, and they couldn't get access to capital. And that's just a fact. And it's a system.
Today, Azelle's has 17 locations. A success story built on hard work, a tasty recipe, and plenty of luck that allowed Azelle's to beat that system. A victory fueling the new initiative from Azelle's called Rudd's Rub.
The idea started with a conversation with DoorDash during the height of the pandemic. And a lot of businesses were struggling and having a hard time maintaining and staying in business. And DoorDash offered us an opportunity to do a promotional promo campaign to help with sales and our business. It would have increased our sales somewhat, and it was sort of a buy one and DoorDash donate a meal to someone. Well, we thought at the time that would potentially overwhelm the staff. We were pretty busy at the time, and so we opted out on doing that promotional campaign. However, I was aware of a couple, if not more, small black-owned businesses that did not have access to any of the funds by the government or what have you, the PPP funds.
From there?
So with that in mind, I asked, there was an opportunity for us to utilize those funds that they were going to provide us to do a promotional campaign. And if we could use those funds to help support some of the community businesses that had no access. They didn't have relationships with bankers. Some didn't have, you know, CPAs that they work with. A lot of sole proprietors are business that it was just a one owner operator, but important to the community. And some have been around as long as these elves have been in business. And I was aware of one in particular that just could not afford to stay in business because his business was closed down. He was not getting revenue coming in to just pay for the lease of the equipment that was necessary to maintain his business. And people maybe were going to come and take the machines away. So he came to mind. Then there were a couple of others that I was aware of that were displaced due to the gentrification in the Central District. I thought it could be a huge benefit if we could utilize those funds and give out grants through an initiative. And 3 months later, 4 months later, first quarter of 2021, she had connected with the right people within the DoorDash organization. And it, you know, the initiative aligned with their values.
The idea is supporting black-owned businesses through a new grant program. At first, giving out 20 grants or awards with no strings attached.
A grant where they can use those funds maybe to hire an accountant, a bookkeeper. There's consultants out there that could help with small things like with their social media platform, a website, build up a website to give them a presence out there, a piece of equipment, plus a lot of times, just knowing that there are people out there that care and that there's help on the way adds so much value and energy and momentum to someone that's out there that's barely moving and, you know, maybe looking at, I don't know if I want to do this any longer.
This initiative is only the beginning, he says, of a legacy project designed to continue supporting black-owned businesses for years to come.
So hopefully through this initiative, we can help bring more awareness to the need for support of our Black-owned businesses.
You can become a grant partner or find out how to apply for the grant at the Izell's Chicken website or at mynorthwest.com.
That is Hannah Scott reporting. Great service there. And it really is Seattle's Morning News with Dave Ross this morning. He is live on the broadcast with us this morning. Hey, Dave.
Yeah, good to see you. And joining us is CBS Foreign Affairs analyst Pamela Falk. Pamela, I've had a lot of time over the last month to basically mainline C-SPAN. I've listened to all sorts of discussions about Afghanistan. And there are so many commentators who feel that America is done as a superpower. Is America done as a superpower?
Well, I have to backstep a second and say welcome back, Dave.
Thank you.
It is great that you're back, and it's a day to celebrate. So now on Afghanistan, no, America's not done as a superpower, but certainly America's credibility has been undermined by the entire chaotic exit from Afghanistan. And so as you see these daily issues, in other words, the takeover of the final province by the Taliban on Monday, the questions about the Americans that are trying to get out and have been left behind, the questions of ISIS and Al-Qaeda terror groups that remain there, and of course the final big piece, which is the humanitarian crisis that's going on. All of that leaves the United States in a position where Russia and China are stepping in. They're very friendly, if I can say it that way, with the Taliban. They're trying to reestablish relations, although Russia said they will wait for formal recognition. They've blocked the U.S. at the Security Council on any more measures that the United States would like to make, such as a safe zone to get people out. And you're seeing some great power struggles right now about Afghanistan that are being provoked, really, by Afghanistan. So the United States is not out of its great power status and world power status because, of course, it is still the strongest economy in the world. But in terms of alliances, there are a lot of questions after this exit from Afghanistan.
And what is the strategic advantage of Russia and China getting close with Afghanistan or even the Taliban?
Well, of course, they're still neighbors, Colleen, of Afghanistan, and they have to worry about the terror groups within Afghanistan under the Taliban. There's no question, and UN has issued quite a few chapter and verse on the safe haven that the Taliban has given to both Al-Qaeda and somewhat of an arch enemy, ISIS, even though they don't agree with them, but they do side and support Al-Qaeda. So both of those things are an issue for all of the superpowers in the world and the world powers, so to speak, and the superpower of the United States. But China and Russia have decided to befriend the Taliban and try to make sure that there is more contact. The United States is dealing with an adversary, no question. We have to deal with the fact that the United States did not support the Taliban. The Taliban, all you have to do is look at pictures of the Taliban. This is a very, I'm sorry to say it, but ragtag group that did succeed in overthrowing the $88 billion funded Afghan army. But when you look at them, there's no chain of command. When you understand the new leader, Abdul Ghani Baradar, they've been living in hiding for years. They supported and actually created the entire illicit drug trafficking in Afghanistan in order to fund themselves. So 80% of heroin comes from Afghanistan today. They did give safe haven to the terror group. So to try to rely on them or even recognize them is going to be a very big issue. Now, the one group that is inside the country is the UN. The organization, as an organization, so 20 UN agencies, some you know very well, UNICEF, the Children's Agency, Humanitarian Refugee Agency, are staying in, as are other NGOs. So the U.S. is going to have to rely on them to know what's going on the ground. They're hearing reports of human rights violations and how the Taliban deals with what's going on in the countryside is another question. Governing is a very difficult thing. So the U.S. did block an IMF, an International Monetary Fund payment that was about to go and had been scheduled for the President Ghani and secular government, and they blocked that. So there's some leverage that the United States has in Afghanistan, but Russia and China are trying to make friends. And Pakistan, on the other side of Afghanistan, has been funding and fighting with the Taliban. So you've got this vast swath of territory that is now Taliban-friendly or Taliban-ruled that the United States is going to have to deal with on all these fronts.
Okay, but what about the problem the Taliban face? Now, from what I've read, there is a huge humanitarian problem in Afghanistan. People can't even get food. We've also planted the sparks of protests where you see women demonstrating now against the Taliban. Are they just going to shoot everybody? Because they're not going to have much of a country left if they do that. And how much patience do the people of Afghanistan have for these amateurs who clearly haven't shown that they can run a country?
Right. I think that's the problem. I mean, the answer is not a lot. And I think it's very hard to put the genie back in the bottle for the period when Afghanistan was run by the Taliban, when there were human rights abuses, when ethnic Tajik and other minority groups were jailed and killed, and the women were not allowed to go to school and go out on the streets without a family member, a male family member, and certainly the wearing a burqa or a hijab. All of that is going to stress the society. Now, on the humanitarian crisis, the Secretary General came out this weekend and said this is a catastrophe waiting to happen. I mean, it's just, they're, first of all, they're heading for a drought. Second, they haven't been getting food during all of these fighting crises. They have COVID incredibly strong. They don't have medical facilities. So the UN is staying in and other NGOs to try to meet that need. And, of course, the U.S. is the largest contributor to those agencies. But if Afghanistan goes south in terms of just a country that has failed, there's a even bigger problem. And that is what Russia and China are trying to do. They're trying to aid and meet the needs. Now, the U.S. is also supporting the agencies that are staying in Afghanistan to meet those needs. But all of that is taking place at a time when the U.S. is reserving judgment on whether it even recognizes the Taliban, holding back on money to the Taliban government, and with good reason. They're waiting to see if they can in any way control their people in those provinces from going into homes for the helpers of the United States, the drivers, the translators, all those. They didn't all get out and not go into their homes and just kill them, and also with women and girls. So what we're getting from inside the country is mainly from the NGOs and the United Nations, and it's not good. So part of the question is, where are the priorities? U.S. priority, no question, and the Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense are in the Gulf right now, trying to deal with Qatar to deal with refugees. Wow. But the U.S. doesn't have much other than indirect contacts with the Taliban to find out what's going on. And so all of this means the next steps will have to be, first of all, keep a process open. You saw the veteran-led rescue groups back and forth with the Biden administration trying to get some U.S. citizens left behind out. But all of it makes for quite a mess. And
it does sound that way, Pam.
Something the Biden administration will have to deal with, yeah.
I mean, you are just a treasure trove of information, and everything you've said today is so illuminating. I wish we had more time, Pam, but we ran out of it.
Right. CBS No,
News.
No, no. There's, for better or worse, Colleen, this story has legs, so we'll
Absolutely.
Back on it.
We'll be talking to you, I'm sure, if not every day, every other day about this. CBS News Foreign Affairs Analyst Pam Falk and the namesake of the show, Dave Ross, joining us for this interview. Thanks so much, Pam.
Thanks, Pam.
It's time for your daily dose of kindness now. It is sponsored by Heritage Homecraft. As kids head back to school, a Grammy-nominated hip-hop group called the Alphabet Rockers have a message about diversity and privilege. CBS's Jamie Yucas shares how they're standing up to racism and breaking down barriers.
It's something that I might need you to do.
It's the jam right here.
Just because you say we need equality too.
E is for equality.
If you don't look like me, will you stand on my back?
And what you're hearing is no illusion. The Alphabet Rockers rap about inclusion.
We're here to represent our school and our people. If you don't know, now you know I'm black and Chicano.
The preteens began contributing to the lyrics, hoping to inspire kids to wake up and stand up for others.
I'ma stand up for you. I'ma stand up for you.
Do you think you can change the world?
Yes, most definitely.
You do?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a new generation. Things change.
The group was founded by Caitlin McGaw and Tommy Solotti Shepherd, who teamed up to tackle discrimination.
There's no words to describe what our country will turn into if we don't turn it around.
The music is a chance for us to be on that journey together and say, yes, your voice matters.
Let's talk, everybody belong.
We first met the kids in a recording studio after their album earned them a second Grammy nomination.
Yeah.
COVID forced them to take their message online.
People get judged for who they are.
Most adults think that we're supposed to just sit back and be cute. But we have powerful ideas, and we can use those to create a better world.
They created an anti-racism course for families in the hope of sparking conversations about equity, empathy, and race.
For folks who haven't been engaging in this conversation, it might be a little harder, but it's definitely necessary.
The Rockers are working on a new album to be released next year. They hope the new songs will be both a link to the past and a bridge to the future.
I hope that families can have conversations about what's going on in the world, racism, ageism, sexism, all the isms. We're going to be leading everybody soon, and it's important that we know we have that power from a young age to say what we believe is right.
It's music with a message, making the world better, one beat at a time. For CBS This Morning, Jamie Yucas, Los Angeles.
Now from the G and Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon, right here on Cairo Radio, right after Seattle's Morning News. It's G's. Scott, how was your holiday weekend, G?
It was great. It was really good. I mean,
yeah?
This is when you know that your time away is good. You judge it by when on Sunday, I was like, oh man, I guess tomorrow I got to go to work. Oh no, I'm off tomorrow. When you, that moment, if you can bottle up that moment of thinking you have to work and then finding out, no, you don't have to work, that right there makes your vacation great.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, we have to talk football. First of all, we haven't chatted with you since KJ Wright announced he's joining the Raiders. It was a really heartfelt video he left for the 12s, though. I know he's your bud, too. What went into this?
Yeah, he wants to play still. We talked over the weekend, and we talked before he made the decision. And ultimately, of course, he wanted to stay here in Seattle, no doubt about it. This is where his family is. This is where Seattle, he wants to make Seattle his home for the rest of his life. This is where he's going to be. So it's going to be tough, if you will, going to Las Vegas. And, you know, you're not really moving your family out there. So he wanted to play.
Oh, so his family stays back here?
Yeah. He doesn't want to take them to Las Vegas. And that's sometimes the hard part of being a professional athlete, having to leave your family. And you're not always in the situation where you stay because, you know, he has kids in school. And if anybody knows what it's like to have kids in school, you just don't just up and just go. But anyways, right. he wanted to still play football, Colleen. And that's really the most important part. And one of the best ways to kind of explain what happens when football players get towards the end of their careers and maybe a team doesn't pick them up. You know, it's not as glamorous or as like, oh, he was such a good player. He retired. Good for him. No, because a lot of them are like, I still want to play football. So it's the equivalent of like a breakup and somebody's like, hey, I'm just not into you anymore. Right. And so in the case of KJ Wright, he's had in a relationship and been in a relationship for 10 seasons, for 10 years, all he's ever known. As a matter of fact, that was a good relationship. Absolutely. They didn't break up on bad terms or anything. They still friends. But in this case, it's like, we're still friends, KJ. And you know what? It's not you. It's me. And that's what basically the Seattle Seahawks said. And so as he gets ready to go to the Raiders, it is bittersweet. It is hard. If you are a Seahawks fan, I told KJ the other day, I talked to him yesterday. I said, look, man, I love you, but I'm not liking any videos of you in a Raider uniform. I don't sure. like you in that uniform. You're still a Seahawk. And he's like, I get it. I respect that. He knows he's a Seahawk. And he's number 34 now, Colleen.
Oh,
he's 34.
He has to change his number too?
Well, yes. Things had to change. I would hate that.
That's what I would hate more about moving to a different team if I were a pro football player.
They changed the locks, Colleen. They changed the locks on them.
Well, and they open against the Colts on Thursday. Is that in the bag, that game?
Nothing is ever in the bag, right?
What I'm trying to get at is, do the Colts suck?
The Colts, the Colts have a lot of problems. And it is still a road game, but it's still the NFL, right? Like, you might have problems with your starters, but sometimes you never know who that next man up is going to be. So the Colts are still going to be a tough game. I think the Seahawks, they start off their season. It's going to be a tough season, especially when it comes to how they start off their season. They start off on the road, then they come back at home, and then they go back two more back on the road. So that's going to be tough in that regard.
And pardon me, the season opens Sunday on the road against the Colts. Now, you're just back from Ohio. Sully just got back from Wisconsin, right? Wyoming. One of those W states.
Sully went to Wyoming. I was in Minnesota.
You were in Minnesota.
Yeah, because they played there.
You saw them play. Yes. Yeah, you saw your son. Okay, I got this. Yep. Sorry. This is my weakness in sports showing. Tell me about that game. How'd your son do?
He did all right. He didn't play as much as he wanted to. He got some early snaps early on in the game, and there was a play his way, and the defense kind of sniffed it out, and so he's a little upset about that. But there's patience there. They got the win. I thought Minnesota was a very tough team that they went to go play on the road, and then they get ready to play Oregon on Saturday at the Shoe in Columbus. So I'll take off and go and see that game.
Ugh. That sounds so great to have a college-aged kid playing these big games. I mean, what an exciting time for both you and Sully.
Can I just be honest with you? It's exciting, but you want to know what's even more exciting?
What?
I ain't got to give him no money.
So he's earning money now because of because of some rule changes with NCAA?
Yeah, a little name, image, likeness, right? You're able to sign some cards here, make an appearance there. You know what I mean?
And you taught him how to save, right?
Right. So I'm looking around like, yo, maybe I should just, the money, I'll go to Dubai or something. You know what I mean?
It's all for you now, G. You worked hard raising those kids, and now it's
I'm still paying out-of-state tuition, by the way, as a walk-on dad.
hey, but Sully, he got his first snap, huh?
Yeah, he got a tackle too in the game. So he's actually on the spreadsheet somewhere with a tackle. So yeah, I'm happy. He played great.
That's exciting. Well, thank you, G. Appreciate the time.
Guys.
We'll talk to you tomorrow. Okay. 8:14 on Seattle's Morning News with Dave Ross. Good morning. I'm Colleen O'Brien. Dave is slowly re-entering the show. We heard him live last hour, and you'll start hearing more of him as the days go on, especially next week. So never fear. Dave is making his triumphant return after some heart surgery. Tuesday mornings, we go live to our nation's capital and Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter David Farenthold at the Washington Post. David, you've been busy since we spoke to you last week. What's going on right now with the Trump beat?
Well, one thing we were really interested in was Trump Tower, you know, the icon of Trump, the heart of his business, the place where he announced his campaign in 2016. It's not doing very well. It's Trump's home. It's the headquarters of his business, but it also has 11 floors of office space that are pretty important for him. He has a huge loan that's collateralized with those office space floors. It's due next year. He needs to fill them. He needs money from them. And we looked at the tenants there and found that a couple of them, some major tenants, had basically moved out, fallen behind on rent, and moved out. But Trump has one really steady, very good customer there, and that is his own political operation. His PAC rents an office on the 15th floor there. So basically they use political donors' money and turn it into private revenue for Trump's business for an office that the PAC barely uses.
Wow. So what does that do for Trump? Because I thought he was living at Mar-a-Lago, not in Trump Tower.
Well, he has a home on the top floor of Trump Tower, but officially his voting address is Mar-a-Lago. So I think he still goes to Trump Tower in the summer at least one day a week.
How does he get into New York without being noticed?
He gets noticed. He gets in a big motorcade at Trump Bedminster and drives in usually later on a Sunday night after dinner and leaves, you know, midday on Tuesday.
Oh, this is surprising way out here on the West Coast. I feel like the news of former President Trump has all but dried up.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot less interest in him now. A few weeks ago, we were there to see him pull up, you know, wave to 10 or 20 people who are gathered there. And then he leaves again a couple of days later. He's doing some
supporters?
Work. Supporters that we saw, at least.
Okay, sounds good. You never know outside of Trump Tower.
And it's sort of tourists. I mean, people just sort of gawking, probably more than supporters.
Absolutely. Well, and also important to continue to, even though the interest in him has dried up, still important to follow the money, follow the investigations, because a former, chief financial officer of Trump's organization, Alan Weisselberg, you wrote about him along with one of your colleagues. He was indicted earlier this summer on 15 felony counts and has now agreed to testify to the grand jury. So where's that going?
Well, in that case, Alan Weisselberg, his chief financial officer, has been indicted. So far, we don't know that he's agreed to testify before the grand jury. There's another player in this drama named Matthew Calamari Jr., another Trump executive who has agreed to testify. We're trying to figure out what happens next. As you said, Weisselberg has been indicted on 15 felony counts, all related to a scheme where he allegedly defrauded the IRS, defrauded the New York State Taxing Authority by hiding some of Trump Organization executives' pay, including some of his own pay, from the tax man, so they had to pay less taxes on him. The question is that it? You know, the New York Attorney General and the Manhattan DA have been investigating Trump Org for years. They've gotten Trump's taxes. They have thousands of pages of documents. Is that all they're going to get? Or is there some other shoe left to drop? And this is not, I don't think, an open-ended investigation, because Cyrus Vance, the Manhattan DA, who's been leading the criminal case, he didn't run for re-election, so he is out of office at the end of December. And if he is going to try to put this, you know, the investigation to bed, he only has a few more months to do it.
It seemed like during his time as president, at any moment, somebody was going to get him, right? Everybody was investigating him. Everybody was, you know, from journalists to, you know, DAs, everybody was about to get him. You know, the impeachment was the end of all of that. And
Mueller, sure.
Yeah, exactly. Nothing seems to stick on this man. Is this just real life, how investigations play out, and they're more boring than the movies? Or is it really that he just is escaping? Or maybe he didn't do anything. Maybe he's clean as a whistle.
Well, I think there's two possibilities. We haven't seen the end of this. One is that, yes, he didn't do anything that breaks the law. And that's partly because the world of New York City real estate developers includes there's a huge amount of sort of leeway built into the law for them. They can mislead people to a degree. They can mislead the taxing authorities to a degree. There's a certain amount of hyperbole and fibs that apparently are taken for granted in the world of New York real estate. So, you know, it's hard to prosecute them for things. It's not like, say, the SEC. If you were a publicly traded company, there's a lot more stringent rules about what you can say and what you can't say. If you're in New York City real estate, you can stretch the truth a long way before it becomes illegal. So that's part of it. He
good
lives his business. Yeah, he's right. It's a good career change. His business exists in a world where the laws are not as stringent as they are in other places. The other thing is that, you know, white collar investigations now, and that's what this is, it, you know, white collar business investigations have come to turn so much on email. You know, executives hang themselves with the emails. I think we saw that with the Sackler, the Purdue Pharma case. Wow. There's been a number of other cases where emails are what undid people. And Trump, you know, whether it's to hide his tracks or just because he's old, doesn't use email, never has. And so that makes it a lot harder to say, you know, this happened because Donald Trump said it. And that's a really important part of this case, to show that Trump himself knew what he was doing was wrong and ordered people to do it anyway. Without email, it's hard to get that sort of smoking gun in an executive case.
Wow, that is incredibly smart, whether you said it was purposeful or it's just because he's of an older generation. I do remember reading that he still had his assistants cut out newspaper clippings that mentioned him, and he would read them every morning. So he didn't go online and search his name. He would ask for those newspaper clippings. Is that still the case, or was that just lore?
No, I think that is. And he's somebody who sends handwritten notes and, you know, he'll take the newspaper clipping and write, you know, great job or whatever, you're terrible, whatever he wants to on the clipping and send it to people. Even his tweets often were done by somebody else. He would say something and then somebody else would write it down and tweet it.
That's
so,
right.
You know, that whether it's, like I said, whether it's habit or purpose, you know, insulating himself a little bit from email is, I think, maybe helped him.
Who do you think would have taught him those kind of tricks? His dad?
Well, maybe. I mean, if Fred Trump was long ago pre-email, you know, there's always this lore about Roy Cohn, who was this famous lawyer who was investigated communists and with McCarthy in the 50s and then worked for members of the mob. You know, he would always say, you know, don't write what you can say. Don't say it if you can nod, you know, this sort of mafia code that I think good lawyers teach anybody, that, you know, try not to write down things you're doing as much as you can. Trump seems to have absorbed that from somewhere.
Interesting. Taking a turn to the current president, Biden, he's touring some flood disasters in New York and New Jersey today, but his approval seems to have taken a hit after withdrawal from Afghanistan. What's happening there?
That's right. His approval across the board, which had been really steady for the first 5 or 6 months of his term, has taken a hit from Afghanistan, I think from the surge in Delta COVID cases. You know, this is Biden's. He was kind of in a honeymoon period for a while. This is his first real crisis. Afghanistan was his first real crisis. And COVID is, you know, this is a resurgence of a crisis I think he believed he had beaten. You know, he's now the end of summer, the Labor Day. The Afghanistan investigation is, I mean, Afghanistan withdrawal is over. It's a chance for him to reset and start to rebuild that approval rating. And I think he's hoping he can do that through the passage of big legislation in Congress, through this infrastructure bill and also through this big Democratic spending bill. I think that plus, you know, an increase in vaccinations and a decrease in COVID, those are the things I think he's hoping can rebuild his approval rating. I mean, granted, it's still 2021. If he's going to run for re-election, he's got a long time to do it.
Right. Are popularity polls still useful? I feel like, I mean, I know it's called an approval poll, but I kind of call it a popularity contest. Like, how popular are you right now?
Yeah.
And it goes back and forth so often. Is it something the president actually looks at to determine his actions?
I mean, these are politicians. So I'm sure they do. But I think in his case, the more important barometer for him is going to be the midterm elections in 2022, which are still more than a year away. But if the Democrats, you know, he needs to give Democrats more than himself something to go back and run on. And he needs to hope that the Republicans continue to, you know, embrace things like fighting mask mandates and things like that that aren't very popular. You know, there's a long time before 2022. But if I was Biden, that's the number I'd be watching. You know, the generic ballot, the polls about who are you going to vote for in 2022. You know, his popularity affects that, but it's sort of an indirect measure.
Sure. Absolutely. All right. David Farenthold, Pulitzer Prize winning reporter from The Washington Post. You ever get tired of hearing that?
No, never. Never. Say as much as you want.
Good for you. I love saying it, too. David, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.